This is Car Expert.
The Isuzu Ute finishing ninth, so inside the top 10, up 174%, a record for that brand.
It might be one of the nicest looking BMW interiors in recent history.
It's a clever move for getting some cash and some experience with people who maybe don't want to buy a car, but it also is just cementing the Toyota brand name in these people's minds down the track.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner, and welcoming this week, William Stopford.
Hey, Mandy.
And Scott Colley.
Hello, Mandy.
Now, you've been talking about this for weeks on end, Scully, and we just haven't had a chance to talk about it on the podcast. You recently attended an AMG driving event. Where was it?
So we were down at Phillip Island, which is one of my favourite racetracks that I've driven at. Not driven at a heap of them, but of the ones I have done, it's up there. And it was like a combination of the Level 1 and Level 2 Mercedes AMG drive days that they do. So in the morning, we got to drive an A45 on a slalom, do some drag races in an E63 and an AMG GTR and drift a C63, as you do.
Wait, so you got paid to do this?
Well, I mean, I haven't been paid this month yet, but at some point I assume it'll arrive in my account, yes.
Oh, man, what a day.
Paid by Car Expert, that is, not by Mercedes, of course. And then in the afternoon, we went out on all those cars on track. So the idea behind it is that if you own an AMG and you want to learn how to drive it quickly and you want to do it in someone else's car instead of your own, you can pay to do these different drive days, and you've always got an instructor in the passenger seat. There's a whole lot of, I would argue, very brave, either ex-racing drivers or young racing drivers who talk you through things like your brake pressure, how to feed in the throttle and your lines on the track, and try to essentially improve your driving at the limit. And it sort of culminates at the end of the day in a couple of laps in the AMG GTR, pretty much flat out around Phillip Island, which is just awesome. I've got a video on my phone that was taken from an in-car camera, and I'll show anyone who wants to see at the moment and anyone who doesn't want to see, actually, how it all went.
Can you actually use your own car on these days as well?
So there's a fleet of pre-prepared cars from Mercedes-Benz. They're all identically specced. So there's a whole lot of white C63s, black E63s. And the reason for that is the techs will look at them as they come in every single time. So in each of our sessions, we'd go out in the C63, do a couple of laps, swap car, swap instructor, but there'd also be a pit crew that ran in and checked the tyres and the levels and everything to make sure they're all in good nick. So because there's quite a few people moving through all day and you got to jump from station to station to station, it doesn't really make sense to use your own. But I think also for Mercedes, it means they can actually make sure the cars are in really good condition, because obviously you don't want someone C63 with bald tires and fluid levels not quite right and all that sort of thing, which obviously you don't necessarily expect of the owner of a luxury car, but there's no guarantee they'll look after it the same way. You don't want them going 250 k's an hour down the back straight and having something go wrong.
The majority of people that were there, did they own an AMG or were looking to buy one and wanted to, you know, test them out?
So the day that we did was actually the day before the owners came along. It was a day for journos and media, and there were some much prettier people there who apparently are called influencers who took all their own photos. And, some of them were very good drivers too, actually. I was impressed. But the day is open to Mercedes-AMG owners. I don't think it's open just to the general public, and I think the reason for that is you've got to have some understanding of the brand, but also – everyone would want to do it. So my understanding is it's available to Merc owners first up. And I know some dealerships will push this as a part of a package when you buy the car, because it's a really big drawing point to be able to actually learn how to drive the car quickly. I'm sure it could be arranged if you were willing to do it, but it would be a little bit trickier to do if you weren't a Merc owner.
So let's get back to this GTR. I want to know all about it, because there's not very often you get to drive one of these beautifully designed cars. What was it like?
It was awesome. It was really, really impressive. I know that's not surprising that a big V8 two-door Merc is impressive, but it definitely felt like more unique than I expected. All of these AMG cars, with the exception of the A45, have a variation of the same engine. The C63 is also rear drive, and all the controls and the buttons and the bits and pieces are shared between them in lots of different ways. So you sort of sit in the GTR and it definitely feels special. You've got the really high transmission tunnel, but there's also a lot of familiar to it. And then you actually drive it and it just feels like everything's been ramped up 5 or 10% over the other cars in the range. The steering's quicker and a bit heavier. the way it responds, the throttle is different. You're sitting right out over the back axle, so it feels quite unique in that sense too. There's all this bonnet out in front of you. And if you're tall like me and wearing a helmet, then your head's slightly on the roof. So it feels like an AMG, and it's got that really distinctive sort of muscle car kind of character to it. Sounds unbelievable, but it feels a degree more special again. And I think if you were to own one and drive it on the road, people would just spend all the time staring at you because it looks awesome in person. It's really compact, but has those fat hips, and it's just great.
So sexy.
I do think I need a C63 wagon in my life, though. Of all the cars I drove, the C63 was the one that excited me, I think, maybe the most, because it kind of was approachable and fun and fast, but also it just felt like every time coming out of a corner, as you straighten the wheel, you could feel the back coming around, and it felt like alive and playful in a way that the others maybe didn't.
So
maybe
did you
that's
drive
just because I was more confident in it.
Did you drive the sedan or the wagon?
We had the sedan.
Okay, yeah.
I've just decided maybe the wagon's better so that I can fit bikes and stuff in the back.
Oh, very sensible. Very sensible. Yeah. Well, and Scully wasn't joking about showing everybody the video because he courted me and showed me the GT video, which, by the way, is not as interesting when it's just a video from inside the car. You've got no concept of how fast you're going, but I'm sure it was really nice. I am jealous. I will nurse a grudge until everything in my life tastes of poison because you got to go and I didn't.
It does sound a bit silly, but you do sort of show people these videos. And when you're watching like race cars or professionally shot stuff, a lot of work goes into making the cars look fast because obviously there's no trees whipping by and all that sort of thing. So cameras are set low and cameramen pan quickly. And when it's just a static camera out the front, you spend a lot of time going, I know this doesn't look fast, but I'm doing 200 Ks an hour there. And it really does lose the effects.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I see you have written a story on carexpert.com.au. So if anyone wants to know more, they can head over there and read the story. All right, time to talk about this week's biggest car news, and the 2022 BMW iX pricing and specs have been released this week, Will.
Yes, I've got to admit this caught me a little bit by surprise because the BMW iX range is actually going to start at $135,900 before on-road costs. That means it's actually going to come in under the Audi e-tron and the Mercedes-Benz EQC. Now, unlike those models, this is on a bespoke electric vehicle platform. It's been designed from scratch to be an electric vehicle. Now, the e-tron and the EQC, they're based on existing internal combustion engine platforms in the Audi and Mercedes-Benz lineups, respectively. So I was a little bit surprised to see the iX undercut it. It's going to come here in three variants with two different all-electric powertrains. So the iX xDrive 40, gotta love BMW trim level names, has got 240 kilowatts of power and 630 newton meters of torque. And the xDrive 50 has 385 kilowatts of power and 765 newton meters of torque. So both of them have dual motor all-wheel drive. That's what xDrive means. But there's a little bit of a difference there in terms of performance, obviously, and in terms of range. So the xDrive 40 has got 425 kilometers of range under the stricter WLTP test cycle. But the xDrive 50 bumps it up to 630. That's largely because the xDrive 40 has got a 77 kilowatt hour battery and the xDrive 50 has got a larger 112 kilowatt hour battery. And the xDrive 50, as I mentioned as well, is a bit quicker as well. So while it's not quite Tesla Model X ludicrous mode fast, you can do 0 to 100 in 6.1 seconds in the base iX and 4.6 seconds in the xDrive 50. All models come pretty comprehensively equipped. So right from the base level, you've got a 14.9-inch touchscreen, you've got a 12.3-inch digital instrument cluster, you've got a large range of active safety and driver assist technology. You've got leather upholstery that's been tanned with olive leaf extracts because that's part of BMW's sustainability kick here. So as we've been seeing a lot in the industry, there's been a greater emphasis on using recycled or natural materials. So the floor coverings and the mats are made from recycled fishing nets. So there's various elements like that. Perhaps the most interesting feature that the BMW iX has. Now, we all know electric vehicles, they don't really have a very inspiring soundtrack, do they? It's just this kind of whoosh, whir kind of noise. It's kind of generic. But the iX has got something called BMW Iconic Sounds. So it's this artificial engine, you know, like kind of motor sound that they've composed. And they actually had a little bit of help composing it from Hans Zimmer, the famous film and TV composer. No. So I haven't heard it yet, but that does sound very interesting. Now, look, let's just get one thing out of the way. The grill. Yeah, look. I mean, it's there. It's large. It's clever because it incorporates a large number of cameras and sensors. It also has an inbuilt cleaning system and a self-healing function for fixing light stone chips. So it's not just it's not just a pretty face.
I think that might just be BMW prepared for people to throw stones at the front of its new car somehow.
Gosh. You know, and I don't want to pillory it too much because the rest of the car looks pretty, you know, decent. I mean, looks as maybe nicer than an e-tron or an EQC, but that grill, I mean, when I first saw the current M3 and M4 grill, I remember reacting poorly, but now I love it. I love both of those cars. I want one. I don't see that happening aesthetically with this iX, but well, look, I'll reserve judgment until I see one in person.
Two things on the iX. The first is that given its name is essentially the Roman numeral for 9, maybe we should start doing the 2021 or 2022 for the BMW iX in Roman numerals as well, which means it's actually would be the MMXXII BMW iX.
Oh my God. Are you just showing off your knowledge of Roman numerals?
No, I Googled it.
Flex, but okay.
I Googled it to be... 100% sure that I was getting it correct.
God.
The second thing is, I think BMW's been courageous with the design of this car on the outside, and that's up to, you know, whether you like it or not, it's up to you. I personally think it looks pretty hideous in the pictures. But I think it's also been courageous in a few other ways that really could pay off with this car. The first is the pricing. BMW could have priced this over an EQC or an e-tron and gotten away with it, and it hasn't. It's priced the car... I mean, it's still expensive. It's still a luxury car and it's not going to, you know, change the world on that front. But it's priced the car where the car should probably be priced if it were, you know, trying to be really competitive with those vehicles. So, I mean, that's a good starting point. I think also it's been quite courageous with the interior. Mm. Mercedes and Audi have both tried to make their electric cars be really conventional. The e-tron in particular, I was quite disappointed by because it just... felt like a Q5 and a Q7, sort of somewhere in between the two of those inside. Whereas the iX takes a similar approach to the i3 with a flat floor between the passenger and the driver, with a really beautiful floating tablet design on the screen, on the dashboard, excuse me, and with some really interesting options for the trim that if you're hopping out of an X5, you might not be expecting. So, I mean, first up, it's got a silly name and a silly nose, and we can deal with that. But kudos for BMW for actually committing to a direction with its electric vehicles and allowing the iX to be a good electric car, not an EV apologizing for the fact it uses new technology.
And just on that, on the interior is stunning. It might be one of the nicest looking BMW interiors in recent history. And all the press photos have shown it in these gorgeous blue and red, like scarlet red colorways that are stunning. So if it comes here with these interior colors, and people just buy it with a black interior, I will be very mad.
Get ready to be very mad.
Agreed. Oh, no more black interiors. Stop it.
All right, we're going to move on to the next story now. Scully, Toyota has released a new rental app in Australia called Kinto. What does this do?
So Kinto is another car maker trying to get into the mobility game. A lot of car makers, I think, have realized that as people's habits change, as the way we live change, and as, you know, the way that we look at autonomy as opposed to driving ourselves everywhere changes, they need to change as well to keep up with it. So this has been rolled out overseas. It's now come to Australia. And this is essentially Toyota's version of GoGet or of car sharing. You can sign up for the app and you're able to pick up cars from a number of set on-street sites. They're through the Melbourne CBD and through Carlton, as well as some regional towns like Kilmore and Seymour. And you're able to get access to everything from a Prius C or a Yaris all the way through to a Hiace van if you're moving house for it's like a per hour rate plus a per kilometer charge. So this is Toyota essentially saying, we know that not everyone wants to own a car, but we want the people who don't own a car to still be accessing one of ours. And that's obviously clever in a few ways. I mean, the first way is that, you know, Toyota is a really recognized name, and rather than signing up to GoGet, I'd be far more comfortable giving them my credit card details. But beyond that, if you live in a city and you can't necessarily buy a car now, that doesn't mean that in the future you're not going to want to. And if all of your experience of driving a car has been a RAV4 or a Kluger or a Hiace when you're moving house, when you do maybe have kids and move to the burbs, or, you know, when you finally can afford a plot of land and you want to go a little bit further away, the first thing you're going to think about isn't about go-get and isn't about, you know, different branded cars or a random mix of rentals. It's going to be about a Toyota. So it's a clever move for getting some cash and some experience with people who maybe don't want to buy a car, but it also is just cementing the Toyota brand name in these people's minds down the track.
Mm. As if it wasn't cemented enough already.
Yeah, small startup Toyota.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what the price differences are?
So there is a per day charge. Yeah. It depends on the brand. You can do a Prius C for $9.10 per hour plus 30 cents per kilometre, $63 for a day plus 27 cents per kilometre, or $294 per week plus 18 cents per kilometre. So if I were to do my daily commute in a Prius C based on that per hour charge, I'd be paying $9.10 because it can take up to an hour for me to drive into the city, plus 15 kilometres times 30 cents would be $4.50. So it would cost me $13.50 to drive into the city.
It's very interesting that they include the Prius C because that was discontinued here last year. So they must have had some sitting in a lot somewhere.
I think there'd be some left over. I think also if you are going to run a car sharing service, running one with a car that uses hardly any fuel and has electric motors doing most of the work for acceleration and braking probably cuts your maintenance costs right down. And offers a good little taste of hybrid motoring for people. So it's another savvy move, I would imagine.
How are people going to know about this? I'm assuming Toyota Australia are promoting this, but the name is a little bit, you wouldn't have a clue what Kinto is when you first hear about it.
It's akin to Bento.
Oh, God.
You don't have a monopoly on lame jokes, Scott.
Oh, it's the sound of Japanese people everywhere crying as we butcher Kinto as well. I think first up that everyone should just be reading Car Expert where this story is. But it's the sort of thing that I think maybe when your mum or your dad drops their Toyota off to service, they might pick up a brochure. It's the sort of thing that we might start seeing ads for on social media and on media that is, you know, favoured by young people who live in these areas, because you can do that and target campaigns very closely now. I think it's going to be a bit of word of mouth as people return their Toyotas to get serviced and, you know, start talking to their kids about their cars, and a little bit of targeting youths in their places of media consumption to sound like the oldest person on earth.
How do you do, fellow kids?
Yeah, as a youth myself, I feel I'm qualified to say that.
Fair enough. Now, this is pretty cool. Will, we're going to get the BYD T3 electric van coming to Australia at a very affordable price.
Yeah, so they're BYD, as you said, a Chinese company. They're claiming a $35,000 before on-road costs. Starting price for the T3. So that's about the same as a base Volkswagen Caddy. Right now, the only pure electric van you can buy in Australia is the Renault Kangoo ZE, which is $50,290 before on-road costs.
Wow.
So they're definitely undercutting it there. So for those who haven't heard about BYD, they're a Chinese company and they're going to be imported to Australia by a company called Nexport. And all BYD products are going to be sold online through evdirect.com.au, which is the site that's owned by Nexport. So Nexport is a part of the True Green Group investment fund and also supplies electric buses to the New South Wales government. So, you know, this isn't their first rodeo. But basically, the BYD, so it's always these alphanumeric names always get me. The BYD T3 is basically.
Say that five times quickly.
Gosh, I know. And it's not even the most confusing Chinese name. But basically, it uses a 50.3 kilowatt hour battery pack and features a 70 kilowatt and 180 newton meter electric motor. So charging is done through a 6.6 kilowatt onboard AC charger with a claimed recharge time of 8 hours, or there's also a 40 kilowatt capable DC charger with a CCS connector that'll charge the van up in a claimed 1.3 hours. So it has a claimed driving range of 300 kilometers between charges. However, that's under the NEDC standard, which is always a little bit more generous than WLTP.
But yeah, basically, and that would be unladen too, wouldn't you assume?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But what it's kind of being pitched as is a last mile delivery van. So this is a van that's primarily for deliveries in and around town, not for venturing out into the outback to deliver packages. This is the kind of car, this is the kind of van that would be, you know, parked at a depot, being charged, then, you know, taken off for a delivery and then brought back and then just put on the charger again, et cetera.
I think the other thing worth considering with BYD is that the True Green Group, which is backing it, is also very heavily involved in funding Tritium, which is Australia's charging company that provides ultra rapid chargers to Europe and the USA. And what that means is if you are a business and you go to EV Direct, there's so many layers to this company, it's hard to keep track. If you go to EV Direct and you want to buy 5 BYD vans, they can then also put you in touch with the people to install the chargers, to work out a charging plan, to work out your daily usage, and essentially sell these as a package to businesses rather than just a car. This is something that obviously a lot of brands are going to end up doing. And in the USA, Ford's thing with the F-150 Lightning has actually been, we want to sell to enterprise customers in this way as well. But in Australia, it's quite unique. And it means that if you're not quite sure about an electric van or you're not sure who to go to for each part of transitioning to an electric van, these are the guys that you might end up talking to because they can do it all in one hit. So I think in terms of addressing the fear around electric vehicles and around how they'll integrate with your business, the fact Nexport, working through EV Direct, is able to sell you the whole lot and set you all up with it is going to be a really interesting thing that could accelerate adoption.
Where they might run into some headwinds is with crash testing. So there's not actually an ANCAP crash test score yet. So a lot of companies in Australia will mandate, especially if they have large fleets, they'll mandate a 5-star result. So we don't know yet when this is going to be tested. We obviously can't speculate what kind of result it is going to get. It's worth noting it has met all ADR requirements, which is expected. But yeah, we don't yet know if this is a 5-star van.
Okay. All right. And lastly, Toyota has said no to matching Mitsubishi's 10-year warranty, Scully. Are we not surprised by this?
We are not surprised by this. So this came on the back of a move in the United Kingdom. Toyota has extended its warranty from 3 years and 100,000 miles, which is about 161,000 Ks, up to 10 years and 100,000 miles if you service within the Toyota dealer network. In Australia, Toyota already does 5-year unlimited kilometre on the vehicle in general, 7 years on the powertrain and 10 years on hybrid batteries. So it already arguably offers a better warranty if you're doing a lot of driving, given its unlimited kilometres. But yeah, we thought we'd put the question to them anyway and just see if maybe they'd follow in the UK's footsteps. And the answer was no. In Australia, the only brand with a 10-year warranty is Mitsubishi. And just like Toyota in the UK, it has some conditions on it. You still need to service within the dealer network and you still need to use their cap price program to make that happen. So, Toyota would have been following Mitsubishi to do that if it were to make the move in Australia. But for now, 5 years is where it'll remain. And I know that, we always want longer warranties for consumers and better protection. But realistically, given most of the market is at 5 years and given Toyota has a 25% market share or something like that, it doesn't necessarily need to be making this move just yet.
When did they move from 3 years to 5 years? It was only just recently, wasn't it?
It was. So we actually take a 5-year warranty for granted, but realistically it wasn't until 2018 and 2019 that the move became quite widespread. So, Hyundai's had 5 years since 1999. Kia's had 7 years since 2014. Mitsubishi's had 5 years since 2004, but it was Honda, Jeep and Skoda who jumped to 5 years in 2017. Holden, Ford, Mazda and Volkswagen made the jump to 5 years in 2018, and then Subaru and Toyota went within days of each other in January 2019. And since then, we've seen some luxury brands, although BMW and Audi are notable exceptions to that, make the jump as well.
That is the wrap of this week's car news. Head to carexpert.com.au if you'd like to read more. May's new car sales figures, the facts, have been released, and Mike Costello is always the one across it every single month. Hello, Moko.
Hello, Mandy.
It seems like Mazda has had an absolute bumper month, which I'm sure you'll get into in a sec, but how did the rest of the numbers pan out across the board?
Look, there were a few surprises, but a lot of unsurprising results as well. So, yes, Mazda did really well, as you mentioned, Mandy, in second place, up 86% to 10,500 units. So that trailed Toyota, which is always number one. Toyota with just over 21,000 sales, up 46%. The biggest surprise in terms of brands, though, was Kia. Kia, actually, with 7,124 sales and 160% growth, actually finished third. So it made the podium. And in so doing, edged out Ford, Mitsubishi, and Hyundai. Hyundai, of course, being its minority owner and widely seen as its big brother brand. I mean, as recently as 5 years ago, Hyundai's volumes were, you know, two-thirds bigger than Kia's were. So that company has closed down on Hyundai really fast. Nissan managed to finish seventh with just over 4,000 sales ahead of Volkswagen. Another good story is Isuzu Ute finishing ninth. So inside the top 10, up 174%, a record for that brand. And considering it only sells two models, pretty damn good effort to finish inside the top 10, just ahead of Subaru. MG knocking on the door of the top 10, not quite making it this month, although it did grow a lazy 428%. BMW outsold Mercedes-Benz, unless, of course, you include vans, in which case Mercedes-Benz took over from BMW, but given that BMW doesn't make vans, it wouldn't be very competitive to compare them on that basis. Who else did well in particular? I mean, just about every brand under the sun was up, with the exception of Honda that was down 28%. But some of the really big movers and shakers were GWM Havel, that new Chinese startup SUV and ute maker, up 360%. To 1,494 sales and well and truly in the top 20. And also Skoda, up 166%, more than 1,000 monthly sales. That company has really come from the clouds to become a serious volume player. And Volvo Car, the Swedish superstar, continuing its strong form, up 136% to 945 units. Now, you would have heard me saying a lot of, you know, brand X and brand Y being up, which shouldn't really surprise considering this time last year, we were well and truly under COVID restrictions and we're all Melburnians with the exception of Will, of course. So we're all under restrictions again, but last year they were a heck of a lot worse and a heck of a lot longer. So of course, this year's May iteration is going to be bigger than last year's May iteration. All up, 100,809 new cars, SUVs and commercial vehicles were sold. That's up 68% on May in 2020. It's actually the highest performing month of the year, so higher than March, which is unusual, although I imagine June will probably eclipse it again. And all this comes in the context of a market that is wrecked by semiconductor-linked stock shortages, COVID factory shutdowns, all manner of headwinds that are happening at the moment in the economy and in the car world in general. And despite this short stock situation lots of brands are fighting, they all seem to be doing it pretty damn well indeed.
Mike, do you know why Honda was down?
Look, Honda's, and Scott, you're probably pretty well placed to talk about this in particular, mate, but Honda's recently embarked on a move to change the way it sells cars in Australia. It actually wants to be profitable, which it hasn't been for quite some time. So it's reducing the number of dealers that it has. It's reverting to what's called an agency sales model, so there'll be no haggling and no discounts to be had. And it really sees itself as being more of a small-scale brand moving forward. Scully, I remember you writing a story not long ago saying that this is exactly what Honda intended, which seems incongruous that a brand would intend to go backwards, but that seems to be their claim. Is that right?
Yeah, so Honda is actually getting ready to do it next month. July 1, 2021 will be its first month of agency sales. It's been described as probably the biggest change in the brand's history in Australia. So it is a huge shift. At the moment, what happens is Honda head office will sell cars to Honda Australia dealers who will then buy them and sell them as individual traders to customers. As of the end of this month, Honda Australia will control everything. They'll hold all their own stock. They'll have a very different relationship with those dealers. And the idea is that, yeah, they're able to sell fewer cars at greater profit. They're not having dealers cutting each other's lunches by, you know, competing on price or offering different things. And it also means that if you walk into a Honda showroom in Shepparton and they don't have a red Civic, it's much easier for that person to get you a red Civic because all the stock is owned by the same company and they're just a delivery agent. When it gets to the 1st of July 2021 or from then onwards, it'll be trying to sell 1,650 cars a month. How many did they sell last month, Moko?
How many did they sell last month? Let me just bring my list up here. They sold 1,403.
So they've got some room to grow next month.
That's exactly right. Now, if we just touch on the market in general again, just really quickly, I think just to give some context, the annual total now sits at 456,804 sales January to May. That's up 37.5% on the concurrent volume at this time last year. But it's also getting us back to where the market was around 2018. So this is returning the market to where it was sort of 3 to 4 years ago. It's not breaking records, but it's definitely looking a heck of a lot healthier. The other positive was that every region in Australia managed to grow. So every state and territory, regardless, managed to be up. The ACT only 12%, you know, WA and Northern Territory much higher than that. But every single region consistently grew. And the other good news, of course, is it was the private market doing the dominant driving here. So more than half of all vehicles sold were to private customers. So it's not business fleets doing all the heavy lifting. It's actually mums and dads going out and buying their new vehicles.
What about top models?
Yeah, so top models, we had mostly familiar faces. So the Toyota Hilux number one, Ford Ranger number two, and Toyota RAV4 number three. So those three cars are essentially glued to the podium. But there was a bit of diversity there. So the D-Max from Isuzu finished fourth, which is an incredibly strong result from that product. The Toyota Land Cruiser Wagon in fifth spot. Now, we've been hearing for months that suppliers of that thing are just about done as we head towards the reveal of the 300 series next week. But I'm calling bullshit on that because every single month, Toyota still manages to have that car well and truly in the top 10. So they must be finding some behind the couch. Mazda CX-5 in sixth, Mitsubishi Triton seventh, Prado 8th, Corolla 9th, and i30 from Hyundai in 10th spot. So really dominated by dual cab 4x4 pickups, but a couple of mid-size and large SUVs and mid-sized hatchbacks in among the mix as well.
We've been hearing a lot about luxury brands performing really strongly on the back of COVID because people can't go on holiday. You've mentioned BMW had a really good month, but is that trend continuing and are Mercedes and Audi and Porsche still looking really strong as well?
Yeah, so we had Mercedes up 30%, BMW 34%, Audi up 53%. We had Lexus up 66%, Volvo 136%, Porsche up 70%, with Taycan being a particularly strong seller in that car's lineup. So yes, we did see good growth from all the premium brands, but then again, the market as a whole was up a fair bit too. So I wouldn't say luxury brands were growing at a faster clip than anybody else, but they're certainly not dragging the chain either.
Well, just to wrap up VFacts, any fun little tidbits that you found?
Oh, hundreds, Mandy. How long have you got? No, look, so electric cars are interesting. Obviously, we can't include Tesla in this because Tesla, being Tesla, does not submit its data to the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries for publication. So it's the only car brand that we don't know its sales. But if you exclude Tesla, which is the market leader in EV, electric vehicle sales are up more than 300% in the month. Now, that's still a pretty small total, but we are starting to see significant growth. And once that base becomes bigger, any growth has more of an impact. So we are starting to see an upward spike when it comes to EV sales. Once again, China was within our top five trading partners as well that we haven't seen for a while. I've got a quote here from Tony Weber, who is the chief executive of the Federal Chamber of Automotive Industries, and that's basically the peak body of all the different car brands. And he said, while we cannot be certain about the future economic impacts of the COVID-19 situation, businesses and households are showing their confidence by purchasing new vehicles. I expect this situation will continue to improve in the second half of the year. And the result also highlights the outstanding efforts by all parties in the supply chain in continuing to meet demands of their customers in face of ongoing challenges, such as the shortage of microprocessors and shipping delays. And I touched on that earlier, but we're hearing from every single car brand in the market basically that, you know, they're being crippled by a lack of supply at the moment. So it only makes me wonder just how many cars these companies could be selling if they had supply on the ground.
At risk of asking a question you can't answer, June is traditionally a massive month for car makers. There are still big tax incentives for people who want to buy new cars for business. I know Victoria is in lockdown, but are we heading for a massive June?
The only thing that would stop that being the case, well, there's two things that would stop that being the case. Another nationwide COVID lockdown, and let's keep our fingers crossed that we can keep it in Victoria and nowhere else. But also if that supply situation does finally start to bite. I mean, we've been hearing for months now that you're going to, you know, car brands are running out of stock. They still continue to sell heaps of cars, but at some point, surely we're going to see that bite. So, you know, there might be a chance that some of them are lacking stock and that might hurt. But generally speaking, June is the biggest month of the year alongside March. And there's not a heap that convinces me it should be anything other than that again.
Okay. That's a wrap for VFacts. The report is live now at the site if you want to go on and have a full read of that. But we'll move on now to something that you gave a little teaser to us last week, and that's an EV comparison. Can you remind us again which cars took part in this comparison and why you chose them?
Yeah, so obviously my main role, as much as I love covering industry news, is comparisons. And so I've been driving the Hyundai Kona Electric in updated 2021 form. It recently got an update with a new interior and some longer range and a new nose design that's certainly polarized. The Kia Niro, which is essentially its platform mate, and very recently arrived. It's an older car in Europe, but it did just go on sale in Australia. And the Nissan Leaf E Plus, which arrived a month or two ago, which is the extended range version of the familiar Leaf with a longer battery. Now, these three are essentially, if you just put Tesla aside for a minute as sort of an EV-only brand, these are the three EVs or electric vehicles from the legacy car brands that all are sort of at that relatively affordable price point, but also have a significant amount of driving range. So I've taken out those 250-kilometer driving range city EVs and ignored those for the time being and focused really on EVs that have quite usable everyday driving ranges.
Okay. So what sort of driving ranges are they?
Yeah, so look, these are all relatively long as far as things are concerned. So the Nissan Leaf can do 385 Ks on a charge according to the WLTP rating metric. Of course, if it's cold or if you're driving really hard or you're carrying lots of loads, that figure will change. You know, distances are quite slippery figures at the best of times, but that's a pretty good indicator. 455K range for the Kia Niro and 484 kilometres of range for the Hyundai Kona. And all three have batteries with capacities of just over 60 kilowatt hours.
Okay. How long do they take to charge?
Oh, it really depends on how you're charging them. So they can all handle up to 100 kilowatts on a DC charger. The Nissan Leaf uses a CHAdeMO input, whereas the other two from Korea have the more common CCS or more internationalized CCS charge. You know, a 15 or 20 minute charge in one of those is going to give you more than 100K of range. But then you can also use a 7-ish kilowatt AC onboard charger with a wall box that you can set up for a couple of grand in your house and charge any of them overnight as well, which is generally the way that you do these things.
So I can't remember off the top of my head, Mike, but how much do these all cost?
Yeah, so price is obviously the big issue, isn't it, Will? With all electric cars, they're still too expensive. And, you know, there's no beating around the bush here. These are three expensive vehicles for what they are. So the Kona Highlander is the top of the range Kona electric, though there is a lower, less well-equipped version that's a little bit cheaper. But that's 66 grand at list price and 71,400 drive away. Kia Niro Sport, 65,990 at list price or 70,990 drive away. And then the Nissan Leaf E Plus, 64,90 at list price or 64,990 drive away. Now, just to put that into context, you can get a Tesla Model 3 Standard Range Plus for 68 grand. And, you know, the Tesla Model 3, I would argue, is probably a more premium vehicle than any of these three, certainly in terms of its interior layout and over-the-air update potential and design. So none of these three cars are what I would call cheap. Obviously, their running costs are going to be very, very low, and there is a price to be paid for being an early adopter. But any car that's this size that starts with a 6 might turn a few people away.
Which do you think is the better value for money, obviously, with the Tesla out of the picture?
Yeah, look, I mean, frankly speaking, none of them are spectacular value for money, but in fairness, they are all pretty well equipped. I mean, these are top-of-the-range cars. They do have all of the active safety tech, relatively good touchscreens and infotainment systems. They're not exactly lacking. The Nissan is the cheapest car on test. It's also the biggest car on test. So if you're talking about pure value for money, you've got to go with the Nissan Leaf. And I think if you're talking about worst value for money here, well, the Kona Electric is the smallest car and the priciest. So, you know, the Niro probably falls somewhere in between.
What about warranties? How do they compare?
Yeah, so Kia has 7-year warranty. The other two have 5-year warranties, although Nissan and Hyundai will give you an 8-year warranty on the battery, and Kia's battery warranty is only 7 years. So it is a bit convoluted. Obviously, they're a bit cheaper to service than petrol cars, so you do still have to go back every year to get them serviced. But in terms of running costs, they're all much of a muchness, really, and none of these three brands are renowned for being particularly unreliable or hard to service and maintain. So that's certainly not the differentiator. I think, you know, if we're looking at this comparison, we're probably, how are we going to separate these cars? I think it's pretty clear that the Kona Electric is definitely the sportiest of the three. It's quite interesting in the way it's designed. It's got the most interior technology. There's really spectacular screens inside it. It's quite pokey inside, though. Whereas the Kia Niro is sort of, I guess, the more sensible version of the Hyundai Kona. It doesn't look quite as sporty and aggressive, but it's got a bigger boot and bigger back seats. It's a bit more, I guess, plain in the way it's designed, but there are plenty of people that are into that. And the Leaf really does sort of straddle between them. It's not technically an SUV like the other two, but it's actually bigger than either the Kia or the Hyundai. Has plenty of room that puts it sort of somewhere between the other two competitors. And I guess it has the runs on the board. Nissan's been doing EVs for a long time. It's the second generation to wear its name. So there's plenty of people that would have respect for Nissan for sort of being an early adopter in that space. So it's quite easy to sort of see where all these three are coming from, although at the end of the day, they've got a hell of a lot more in common than they do different.
Moko, obviously there's quite a lot in common between the Kona and the Niro. They both share the same battery and very similar outputs. Does that play out in two cars that drive exactly the same? And why would you choose one over the other?
Yeah, they do drive so similarly. So they've got the same power and torque because they've got the same motor. So 150 kilowatt, 395 newton meters. The Hyundai, interestingly, has a slightly longer range because it's a more aerodynamic and very slightly lighter vehicle. It's also 0.2 faster to 100, 7.6 v 7.8 seconds. In terms of the way they're tuned, look, the Hyundai, I think, definitely has a slightly more performance-oriented way that it drives. Its NVH noise suppression is not as good as the Kia's, but it is a bit more agile and grippy in corners. And quite common to EVs is that it's got too much power for the front wheels, which are the wheels that are driven, because you'll be sort of hearing the tyres chirping, not just off the line, but once you're at 50 and 70 and 90, they're still scrabbling and struggling for grip. So the Hyundai definitely feels like a slightly sportier option. The Kia is 90% as sporty and sort of dynamic as the Hyundai, but definitely focuses on practicality a little bit more. It's got a bit more space and a bit more size inside. But you do pay a price when it comes to range and dynamism. But then again, only by very, very small amounts.
Well, suppose one of the last questions is, Marco, how do they drive?
Yeah, look, it's interesting. They've got a hell of a lot in common. So the thing you notice about electric cars is just how quick they feel. So especially 0 to 60Ks an hour, which is what you're doing around town off traffic lights and things like that, you've just got more poke than pretty much any petrol car will offer, because you get instantaneous delivery of torque and then it does taper off as you do climb to higher speeds. The Nissan is the fastest car, so 0 to 100 in just 6.9 seconds. So it is 7/10 faster than the Kona and 9/10 faster than the Kia Niro. I think actually the Nissan has one excellent feature. They've all got adjustable brake regeneration systems, but the Nissan has what's called an e-pedal. Basically, what that means is you flick a button and the brake energy recuperation system goes into overdrive, and it actually causes friction when you lift off the throttle and allows you to barely ever use the brakes. Once you learn to judge how the brake regeneration works, you just lift off the throttle and the car comes to a stop of its own accord relatively quickly. Hyundai and Kia offer similar systems controlled by the paddle shifters, but they're not as intuitive and as clever as the Nissan's. Nissan just has one mode as opposed to four modes, but in my opinion, it works better. The Nissan's downsides, though, are it doesn't have telescopic steering wheel adjustment, which frustrates the living hell out of me, and its cabin feels a little bit low rent compared to the other two. As I sort of touched on before with Scully's last question, the Hyundai is definitely the sporting person's choice. Then again, the Tesla Model 3 is even more dynamic, but it definitely has the sort of sportiness covered, and it's got the longest range. 484 kilometres of driving range is pretty spectacular for a $70,000 EV. And the Kia Niro, look, it doesn't have the sophisticated Australian tune that lots of Kias do because it is an older design, but it still feels relatively nice around town. Feather light steering, nice high driving position, really punchy off the mark. The ride quality is definitely erred towards comfort rather than dynamism, but certainly does the job. I mean, any of these three cars are just beautiful to drive around town. Once you sort of get used to the refinement and the pace of an electric car, you definitely become very, very enamored with it, or I certainly have. But overwhelmingly, to be honest with you, I kept thinking these three cars are so similar. They've got a hell of a lot more in common than they do in terms of differences.
I know I'm cheating here by skipping ahead because I know the result, but why did the Tesla Model 3 win the comparison?
Yeah, well, this is the thing. I actually got prompted to write an opinion column on the back of this comparison because that's exactly the result. Is the winner is actually none of them. And it's not because they're necessarily terrible cars. In fact, you could make a case for any of them. I'd probably lean towards the Kia Niro just because it kind of balances what the Leaf and the Kona offer, but sort of sits somewhere between them and therefore is probably the best compromise. But if you have a look at the Tesla Model 3, it's pretty much the same price as either of them. It's got a smaller battery pack, but its clever motors and aerodynamism means its driving range is about the same as the Niro's and longer than the Leaf's. It's got far more power than any of them, so 211 kilowatts and 375 newton meters. So it's the fastest car, just 5.6 seconds to 100. So it's a lot quicker than the other three cars tested. It's rear wheel drive, not front wheel drive. So you've got that dynamism up your back pocket. It's so light, 1625 kilos. So it's quite a bit lighter than the other trio on test. Dimensionally, it's bigger. So it's got a bigger boot. It's the only car with a front boot. It's also got more cabin space. It's got a longer wheelbase, which is better for the rear seat room as well. You've obviously got Tesla's brilliant supercharger network of public DC chargers. Tesla is ahead of the curve when it comes to over-the-air updates, as Paul Maritch has found with his Tesla Model 3 ownership. It's the only car with a glass roof and a 15-inch touchscreen, which is much bigger than the others. Its regenerative braking system and handling are superior. It looks cooler. Honestly, we've got a heap of, bespoke competitors like the Polestar 2, Hyundai Ioniq 5, Nissan Ariya, Kia EV6, all coming, and all of those should give the Model 3 a run for their money. But at the end of the day, if you're spending around that 70 grand price on an EV, as good as it was to drive the Nissan, Kia and Hyundai, I just kept coming back to just get the Model 3. And I'm no Tesla fanboy. I'm not a Teslarati. I'm not someone who loves Elon Musk and worships the ground he works on. But credit to Tesla, when it comes to affordable EVs, the Model 3 is still well and truly ahead of its competitors.
Having driven all three of those cars, some of them previously, some as part of that comparison, logistics and that sort of thing, it does really stand out how good that Model 3 is, especially now in Australia where hopefully lead times have been cut. I know the Chinese-made factor on the Model 3 does mean the battery's a little different, but the fact you can order a Model 3 with very similar range to all those cars and get one for the same money, having driven all of them, there's just no competition. And then, I mean, if you do move up the price range as well, the fact you can get a Model 3 that'll do 0 to 100 in 4.5 seconds for just over 80 grand is just remarkable. So, when you told us you were going to write this story, I couldn't have agreed more because the Model 3 is just far and away the best.
Is there anyone in this call who would not get the Model 3 over these other EVs? Mm. Anybody at all?
Nope. Crickets.
Yeah. I think the game will change a bit later this year. Two of the three competitors in this comparison that I've done, Hyundai and Kia, have got ground up radical EVs launching later in Australia this year in the form of the Hyundai Ioniq 5 and the Kia EV6, which share a platform but are bespoke EVs. They don't have anything, to do with a combustion-engined car. There's no combustion-engined chassis or parts involved in these vehicles. And they should really move the game forward for the two brands and give the Model 3 better competition, in my opinion, especially if the pricing is right. Perhaps the disappointment is Nissan, and you know, I have a lot of respect for Nissan because it was the first of the legacy brands to really dive headfirst into the EV space. But the Leaf is a second generation car, and it doesn't feel any more advanced than its first generation competitors do. And also, Nissan has some more exciting, more high-tech new EVs in the pipeline led by the Ariya, but we still don't know when that's going to come to Australia, if it's going to come to Australia at all. So I can't help but think that a bit like BMW before it, Nissan is sort of squandering the advantage that it had in the EV space, even though it offers a product. It's one that probably doesn't keep up with the very best in the business in a lot of ways.
To sort of build on that, Nissan's actually been out in the press, and they've said this to us previously, they've said it to other outlets now as well, as criticising Australia's lack of action on electric vehicles, on criticising Victoria's road tax. But it also offers what, at risk of maybe, you know, having a bit too much of a swipe at Nissan, what is probably the most underwhelming electric car on sale in Australia today when you consider how long it's been building the Leaf and the advantage it should have. It's frustrating that Nissan is so globally is such a passionate advocate for electric vehicles and in Australia is so vocal about them, but just doesn't have a product that can really cash in on the fact it is, you know, prominent in that world.
I think one of the real, you know, ways to prove that is Nissan spends lots of time talking about one feature that the Leaf does have, which is bi-directional charging. Basically, it has the ability to put power from the battery back into the grid, so you can power the house with your Leaf during the day and then charge up your Leaf from the house at night and exchange power that way. And that's a lovely idea, and I can see massive upside in applications for that, natural disaster zones and things like that. But let's be honest, it's not exactly at the forefront of people's minds right now. There aren't many people interested in that technology at this very moment in Australia. And so the company having to lean on that does show that it probably knows that in some other ways that Leaf is a bit outgunned, especially in extended range form, where it is 65 grand. And the idea of buying that over a Model 3, as much as I appreciate what Nissan's trying to do, I just couldn't recommend it. Honestly, I couldn't. And it doesn't fall that far behind its competitors in this test, but that probably says as much about them as it does about the Leaf.
You speak so much sense there, Moko. It's been a pleasure having you on for pretty much half of the podcast this week. Thank you so much.
I really do rabbit on, don't I?
It's good rabbiting. Okay, that's an end to this week's podcast. What events and launches have we got coming up over the next week, Scully?
There's a couple of big ones, actually. We've got the Volkswagen Golf 8 drive up in Sydney and the Kia Cerato launch. They're both happening early next week. We've also got Albor's at the Genesis G70 event today, and he recently drove the Toyota Kluga as well. So reviews for those both coming soon. They'll be early next week. Also out of Melbourne, pending restrictions easing next week, we're going to get a look at the Mercedes E350, which will be very good because I do like a big luxury sedan.
As we all do. Cars in the garage next week, Will. What do we got coming up?
So in addition to that E350 and the Golf Life, we've got a Kluga Hybrid. We've also got a Hyundai Santa Fe in V6 Elite trim. In Sydney, we have got a Kia Niro plug-in hybrid as well. So the Niro came here very recently with hybrid, plug-in hybrid and electric variants. I am currently living my dad dream driving a Kia Carnival SIV6. So it's actually coming in handy because I'm going away this weekend because I can. I'm sorry, guys. Not rubbing it in. I offered to drive because I've got a minivan, so why not? So that'll be a good test of how spacious it is.
All right. Scott Colley, William Stopford, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Mandy.
Thanks, Mandy.